This is The Way We Connect, exploring the way we date, relate, and communicate. I'm Gwyneth Jones, or Gwen. A few months ago, I organized the Trauma and Mental Health in Conflict and Migration online conference as part of my Facebook group, Psychology for Peace Building. This is one of my other projects, but I really feel that the field of peace building could really benefit from a lot more psychological knowledge. And so I created a group to try and bring together people who work in the field of peace building, international development, and NGOs with mental health professionals or psychology academics. Through that group and that conference, I had the honor of meeting Patrick Doherty. Patrick works with Unprocessed Collective Trauma, and as you'll hear in the interview, he believes that the approach we normally take to trauma and therapy is not the correct one. Let's jump into my interview with Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Gwyneth.
Hi. Can you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
You bet. I'm a psychologist. I've been doing psychotherapy for about 40 years. I'm a social activist. I've been doing that as long. Writer, a Qigong teacher, and a guy that enjoys life.
Great. Okay. So tell us a little bit more then about how you came to where you are today, because you have a pretty interesting history.
Yeah, my history. What's really exciting for me these days, and it's very, very exciting, is our understanding about healing community and healing connections, especially as how we deal with the trauma, the collective trauma we all walk in. And that's been a passion of mine since a long time ago. I got out of high school. I joined the Marine Corps here in the U.S. and went off to war in Vietnam. And that was a pretty shattering experience. And I came back to the U.S. and got absorbed in this world that's pretty fragmented here in the U.S. Lots of disconnection, lots of separation, and lots of ways of not ever dealing with the trauma that we had to deal with in a war. The people back here never had to deal with their responsibility in that war. And so I just watched for many, many years in all these different ways I was an activist, the separation between people and what people were willing to experience and tolerate and what they wouldn't. And then as I became a therapist, I sort of got to know it on a really personal and acute level in my own healing and my working with clients. And so I've had this passion about how important it is for people to have real honest and even uncomfortable, sometimes really uncomfortable conversations. Because my belief is that if we can do that, we'll reduce our suffering in the world and we'll reduce our separation. So I have been following that on all sorts of levels. And just the last, I'd say 3-4 years, when our understanding of healing personal trauma and how we separate from each other and from ourselves, how we begin to understand how that's also applicable to the collective. And so I've been doing a lot of work with, a lot of training around working with groups of people and trying to help people feel more connected with each other in order to heal and in order to solve some of the bigger problems that are in our communities.
Would you mind telling us a little more about your own personal experience in the beginning? So you said, you know, you came back to this society where you saw that the trauma wasn't really being dealt with. So how did you deal with it yourself?
When I came back from Vietnam in 1971, I was a pretty messed up young guy before I went. And when I came back, I was pretty shattered. So I spent about 5 years really floating around the country and doing a lot of drugs and alcohol and just really lost. And when I finally cleared my head out of all that, I remember having this awareness about the collateral damage that we did in Vietnam. That really stuck out to me, that the impact we had on not the other soldiers we were fighting, but on all of the people, the women and children and the villages and towns and all the impact we had and the trauma. I didn't know the word then, but I was so aware that we left this country just traumatized. And secondly, I was aware that so many of us that went over came back so differently. You know, people talk about you lose your innocence in war, but I think what you lose often is your sense of goodness, because what happens in war so often is not good. Really bad things happen. So I was aware that a lot of us came back really very different than when we left. And I was also, and I don't know why this struck me, But I realized when I came back that nobody wanted to know what we did. They sent us over there. They gave us the uniforms and the guns and the bullets, and they told us to go protect the country. But nobody wanted to know what happened when we came back. And I didn't know it at the time, but I could see that they were dissociated. They had split off from the reality that we had just done what we did, killed a few million people over there. So in the midst of all that, I was just struggling with the trauma of the war that I carried, because I could feel that nobody wanted to know what I did. I felt bad and ashamed about what I did. And so when I finally got some help, it was always behind a closed door in a therapist's office. And so I learned to talk about my trauma, but nobody ever talked about it as a collective issue. You know, a few times I got involved with other groups of vets, and then we had our little group, but nothing healed because we were in a country where nothing healed. And so I did a lot of work on that. But over the years, what I realized that no matter how much work I did in therapy, no matter how much I worked with my own PTSD, I could be at a dinner party with good friends and people who have same values and ideas I did. But the minute war would come up, the whole room would change and I could just feel alone. I felt ashamed. I felt the trauma come up again. And I always thought that that was me. I always thought that I hadn't healed enough. I always thought that I needed to do deeper work on my personal trauma. And it's just, again, these last few years, I realized that there's trauma in everybody in the room. And I'm the only one that knows there's trauma in the room, and I feel like it's all mine. And so just the last 2 or 3 years, I've been talking about it more and more with small groups of people than larger group of people. And now I can see and they see all the trauma they carry about it. So after hearing it for nearly 50 years, I'm finally able to walk into a room and go, what's happening here has a lot more to do with them than me. But it was a long, long journey to be able to not have to live with that as such a painful and triggering issue for me.
And how was it that you got from that place where, you know, you felt so alone, like you were carrying all of that? How did you start to move beyond that?
Well, I had this incredible experience. I went to a training on intergenerational and collective trauma. And it was a year-long training taught by Thomas Hubel, and I'm part of a group called the Pocket Project. And about 3 years ago now, I went to Israel. The training started and ended in Israel, 6 days in the beginning, 6 days at the end, and lots of training in between through webinars. And so when I went there on the first time, there was 150 of us walking in the room from 39 countries. So it was just a fabulous experience. It was people looking at the intersection of neurobiology, psychology, and mystical principles or energy practices, and what happens with collective trauma. And there was 40 Americans there, but there was 110 people from around the world who didn't have the filters the Americans had. So here in America, when you talk about Vietnam, we have so many ways of denying and we have excuses and minimizing. You know, like every country has a way to, has filters to look at its own trauma. But with this group of people, and as over the days went on, and a lot of people around the world obviously been affected by war and soldiers and armies. And over those days, people talked about it without the filters, and I could feel so clearly that the people around the world knew what we did in Vietnam was an atrocity. They knew that this giant country had invaded this small country. We'd killed between 2 and 4 million Vietnamese, devastated the countryside, and that when we got tired, it was unpopular, we left and never said anything, just moved on. So I could finally feel a validation that there were people that would validate that what happened over there was so much bad happened. And thankfully, as I was dealing with this grief and this guilt and this sorrow, on the second to the last day, I was starting to get mad because I'm in the room with 40 Americans and not one American had come up to me and said anything. And it just felt like here I am carrying America's shame. And this beautiful friend of mine, a Palestinian man, came up to me and I was talking about how mad I was. And he said, yeah, Patrick, nobody wants to take responsibility for the harm they do. Everybody wants to connect with the victim, but nobody wants to be the villain. And then I realized all of these Americans in the room were as guilty as I was in one regard. And I got mad as hell. And the last day I stood up and I spoke and I just said, I'm carrying something that's not mine. And the rest of you Americans here, I'm just really pissed off and I'm tired of it. I've been doing it for 40 years. And right at the end, four of us went into Jerusalem and we were sitting in the old city. And these three American women who I'd become close to sat me down and they said in the most vulnerable and honest way, sort of a summation of what they said is, Patrick, oh my God, we can see what we did. We can see that we did send you off to war, that we were fine with paying our taxes, sending you off with your uniform and your guns. And what you did over there, we can see we did not want to know. And we came home, we knew, we turned away from what you had done over there because we wanted to be comfortable. We wanted to feel good about us as Americans. We wanted to feel good, enjoy our freedom from war. And we turned away from you and our responsibility for what has happened there and subsequently in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we are so sorry we separated from you. We are so sorry we didn't welcome you home. And we're never going to turn away from our responsibility again. Well, that changed my life. And I've been waiting. That was, you know, probably 45 years. And these three women stepped up and said, this is ours too. We'll carry what's ours. So after all that period, and all of a sudden something just happened that shifted my whole personal psychology around it, but also my whole understanding of it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it took so much honesty and vulnerability for them too, right? To be able to admit that they just wanted to be comfortable.
Well, I began to understand, and what's beautiful about this healing collective wounds, healing social despair, healing collective trauma, so many people around the world, this is just this new consciousness is coming about this. And the word that stands out to me again and again is that people don't want to be uncomfortable. And especially those of us who have any privilege, we can regulate so much how much discomfort we allow ourselves to feel. And so, you know, the divisiveness right now in this country and around the world, what's happening is more and more people are only getting together with people who think like them. And it's happening in our relationships. You know, why divorce? Why separation? Why we can't hold on to relationships more? Because we know that we can walk away from discomfort. And we don't know that to have real relationships, be it between two people, be it in a neighborhood or a community, you need a capacity to deal with discomfort. And so what I've been doing with working with lots of different groups on this is, and you need people who are willing to commit to say, okay, I'm going to sit down with this issue and I'm going to commit to being more uncomfortable than I've ever wanted to be in order to understand this issue. Here in the U.S., I'm beginning to work with the war issue. I work with white supremacy. I just work with a lot of different pieces. And so I'm really looking at how to help groups of people increase their capacity for discomfort. Because a lot of these issues we're trying to heal, we can't heal them from the top down. Our heads aren't going to figure out how to deal with the divisiveness in our own communities. We have to figure out how are we going to sit in the rooms with each other and to tolerate the discomfort and to know that what we're all in the room for is a greater good, not just my personal good. And so I'm learning to develop techniques and processes to help decrease the separation and help people tolerate the discomfort and to build the connection.
Wow. So after that big change in you, what did you do with that?
Yeah. So I just spoke with a group of people. I spoke with 25 therapists at a conference who work with veterans. And in the room, I was talking about the collective trauma. So you got therapists walking in and they all believe, okay, we're the people who can see. We understand vets. Some of us are vets. We're the insiders. But what I said to them and what they knew they were walking into is that, well, that's true, but you also carry the collective trauma of war that you have avoided. And so asking these people as they walk in about saying, okay, we all want to help vets, but can we deal with our own discomfort and not just be professionals sitting with the discomfort of veterans? And so what happens to you when a veteran is saying, you know, the country turned away? You know, can you see the part of you that's turned away? Can you bear the part of you that during the last 18 years in Afghanistan, 16 years in Iraq, can you feel the part of you that has lost interest? Can you feel the part of you that turned away and didn't want to know because they're such messy wars? And so I help them sort of build what I call the lifeboat about, can we be in this together and realize this is real human? And can we know that we're not just the heroes riding on white horses to help veterans, but can we also know we're American citizens and we're all struggling to deal with the trauma that's happening in those countries and the incredible trauma that is coming back from the hundreds of thousands of veterans coming back with trauma and the incredible trauma that we have left in those countries, that can we find in us the ways we turn away and can we deal with our discomfort a little more so we might be able to be more humanly engaged in the discussion.
And can you share with us a little bit more about how you do that? So some of the work that you are doing at the moment.
So the collective trauma, my definition of it, and I think about it, so it's probably easy to understand, especially in light of here in the U.S. around genocide and slavery. So everybody knows those are two horrific things that have happened here in the U.S. that we did, our ancestors did. And we know it's not healed at all. And so most of us, you know, certainly most of us good liberals and a lot of conservatives too would to love to heal that issue, but it doesn't heal. And so I think about collective trauma is the glue that holds the structures together that keep us apart. The structures are in place in this country that continue the inequity, continue the privilege that white people have, continue to help us turn away from the ongoing pain of that, and it's built into the system. So the collective trauma is here in the midst of us, but it's glued in place. And so not until, you know, and people have been trying to figure out the structures and change some of the laws and change the rules or the bylaws in different places, but that has not affected the desired change because it's in our bodies. This is what we're understanding, is that the genocide, the attempted genocide committed by my ancestors is in my body. The using of slaves, the kidnapping of Africans and bringing into the country and slavery and the ensuing laws that are so racist. We can see all that as wrong, but the collective trauma is in the structure, but the structure stays in place because that privilege and the racism behind the privilege is in my body.
So definitely it's not this kind of, yeah, like you said, top down, oh, the expert is coming in to fix the situation, but becoming part of it. How would you define the idea of collective trauma?
So a good example is I live in Minneapolis, you know, and I'm an educated guy. I live in South Minneapolis, which is the more middle, upper middle class, predominantly white section of town. And North Minneapolis is the poorer part of Minneapolis. It's predominantly people of color, African Americans, Black people. So when my kids were going to school, they were in public schools. And because I'm an educated white guy, I knew how to get my kids into the best schools. I knew how to get my kids into charter schools. I knew who to talk to. I knew the back routes into getting my kids the best public education as possible. And even at the time, I knew in North Minneapolis, they did not have access to the quality of teachers we had here. I knew the parents didn't have the wherewithal to work the system like I did. And what I did, Gwyneth, is in the back of my mind, I didn't consciously say this, but I felt it. I just said, well, of course, I'm going to get my child the best education possible, because we all said that. And I wish those parents in the North Minneapolis, I wish them well. And I turned my back. And I went and got my kids my best education possible. And it was in that turning away that I was even conscious that there was something so unfair about the system, where the best schools were, where the highest graduation rates were, where the best teachers were. I knew it was stacked against the Black people. And I didn't do anything that made myself uncomfortable to change it. That's how it ends up in my body. I couldn't bear the discomfort because it felt so overwhelming. I didn't know what to do. I felt on my own. And I just thought, well, it's just so hard for everybody. And I turned away. I separated myself once again from Black people who were disadvantaged. And I continued my relative privilege at the expense of Black children's education.
Can I just try to paraphrase you to see if I've understood? When we turn away from somebody who doesn't have it as good as us, we might think at the time we're avoiding something uncomfortable, and we might tell ourselves all sort of stories to justify why we're okay and they're not, right? But in doing that, we're creating a further feeling of separation. And do you think that like contributes towards this unconscious trauma? You know, is it a result of collective trauma, or is this the same thing really?
Yes and yes. So I was born into this. I was born back in the 50s. I was born into a culture that really favored white people, white privilege. And Black people and Native American people, I remember as a kid seeing the poverty. And as we would drive up north going on vacation, and we would drive past these little tar huts on the side of the road where the Native American families lived in the summer. I never quite understood why, but they were just like 12-by-8-foot shacks, and they were really tar-papered shacks. I don't remember saying these words, but I remember saying, you know, why do they live like that? And I remember my parents saying something like, well, that's just the way it is. And so you're born into it, and you learn these ways of looking at it, like, well, it's just the way it is. And there, oh, there's another drunken Indian. Yeah, those people aren't quite as smart. And you pick up all these things without even knowing it. And you build a story about indigenous people. You build a story about Indians that it's really their fault. And that's just the way they are. And so then you look at Black kids, the gang kids. You look at Black neighborhoods. And you just pick up all the ways the culture tells you subtly and blatantly, well, they really don't work as hard as we do. They're really just not as smart as we are. And then you pick up the jokes that happen in your family or in your peer group, and all of a sudden you have a bias that really protects you from any deeper reflection. And because the world around you lives that way, you never have to stop and ask yourself, is that really true? And wonderfully, today, there's all sorts of ways to be challenged by that. And the old denial is being really challenged in so many profound ways, but it's stuck. It's all glued together still, though, but it's because we have learned to turn away from our ancestors. We have learned to rationalize the trauma, and we have learned to not feel bad about what we did.
Are you also familiar with the just world hypothesis? Yeah, how we tell ourselves somehow that if you really work hard, you'll always get what you want. Therefore, these people are poor because they didn't work hard enough.
Here in the U.S., we talk a lot about the meritocracy, you know, that whole thing. If you just work hard, you'll get good merit for what you do. And we're all self-made men, especially, you know, it's like it's up to you. And the whole system is a lie. It's stacked against the people who don't have advantage. And we imagine everybody has the same capacity to engage the system. And it's not true at all.
No, exactly. So going back a little bit to, you know, you're talking about these different ways that we rationalize things, and this builds the further feeling of separation. Yeah, why do you think that is? Is it just because it's too painful for us to confront the reality?
So that's part of it. So when I came back from Israel the first time, it must have been the summer of 2016, there was an article that I read in the New York Times, and it was about sexual harassment in Silicon Valley. And it was about how all these women were still being so really hurt and traumatized by sexual harassment. But one of the ways it was written, and it was so stunning to me, that in the article, there would be sentences that say would something like, women are still being sexually harassed in Silicon Valley.
In the passive tense.
Yes. And it was a period at the end of the sentence. And there were dozens of sentences in this article. And it was almost all about women and what they were suffering, but it was never about who was causing the suffering. And it was stunning that men were mentioned two or three times in the article. It was just incredible. One of the mentions was about how men are feeling picked on around this issue about being the sexual harassers. And so what I was aware of is I looked at these half sentences, as I call them. There's an incredible amount of sexual harassment toward women in Silicon Valley, period. Okay, that's half a sentence. It's a sentence about collective trauma, but it's in the passive form, and there's no life in it. So if we were to write that sentence, if the woman author would have written, women are still suffering sexual harassment in Silicon Valley, comma, because men continue to get away with it, period. That sentence would have drawn such a blowback to the New York Times. Men would have been raging, they would have been complaining, they would have been saying it's not all of us. And she had to write the article so carefully to not upset men. So yeah, so part of it is it's uncomfortable, we're acculturated to it, but secondly, and this is part of what we're understanding now, what holds the collective trauma in place is that if we deal with it and make the changes necessary, some people are going to lose. Some people are going to lose a lot. And the power structures do everything they can to keep the structure in place. And obviously around the patriarchy, we have a lot of really powerful men at the top who want to continue to be in power. But then if we break it down to guys like me and guys like the men I work with, we can feel like how we also turn away because it's going to make us uncomfortable. We're going to have to change our behavior. We're going to have to be different in the world. So we can look at the people in power and understand what they do to perpetuate it. But it's in our bodies too. So this is where the hope is. If we break it down into, can we get enough men together, which more and more men are coming together, and finding where is the patriarchy, sexism, and the violence against women alive in our bodies? Some of it actively, but some of it is in the passive, turning away from how it happens. If we can be willing to go into our bodies and understand how that works and how we turn away from it, maybe we don't have to turn away so much anymore. Maybe we can stay more connected to it and actually affect some change.
And it's about, again, yeah, being able to feel the discomfort, right? And stare into the belly of the beast kind of thing. And
absolutely.
So for those people who are listening who don't really know a lot about this field, don't really know a lot about trauma, you know, you were telling me before that often the mistake we make as a society is to put the blame for the trauma, or at least the focus, on the individual, right? So you're traumatized, you need individual therapy, your experience. Can you talk a bit more about that?
So if we think about the issue of the violence against women, so women have been going to therapy forever to deal with the wounds of sexual harassment and sexual violence. And so they get some help and sometimes even be part of a group, but then they go out in the world, they go out to their place of worship, they go out to their community, and they go to the movies, they go wherever, but they carry that trauma that is a social trauma. That happens in our society at such a pervasive rate. It's a social trauma. But when they're in a dinner party and somebody mentions a friend that was raped, and all of a sudden there's one or two women in the room that were raped, they're rarely going to talk about it. But it's going to rip something open in them. It's going to hurt them. They're going to probably be activated in some ways. And so all the individual therapy they get hasn't stopped the suffering, and it keeps people talking about it in a sort of a top-down manner or a sort of disembodied way. And so what we'd want to have happen in a situation like that is for there to be enough ability in the room for discomfort, for somebody at the table to say, you know what, here we are talking about this issue, but we know it's affected probably some of us in the room. And what do we do with that? What do we do with the fact that we're in a room where it's affected all of our lives in some way? I mean, you can just imagine how what a dramatic change in discussion that would be.
Yeah, and to take it even a step further, you know, there's sometimes this meme goes around Facebook of, why is it that everybody knows a woman who's been sexually assaulted, but no one seems to know a rapist?
Yes, I know. I just saw one of those yesterday too. And it's, I mean, this is where men, so on that very thing, it's like most men know that how much it happens. Most men know of some of their buddies if it hasn't been them. But most men have never asked their partners, their sisters, their mothers, their wives, how has sexual harassment ever affected you? It's stunning how disconnected we stay because it's so uncomfortable. And the issue is alive in all of our homes. And so, yeah, it's sort of like that issue affects just about everybody. And but this is where it takes, Gwyneth, a real desire for people who are willing to say, who is willing to choose this one issue, you know, any of these, sexual harassment from war to slavery, who's willing to be part of an ongoing group of 6 people or 60 people or 600 people and sit down and wrestle with this issue over a period of time and look at what happens to us and figure out how to be supportive of each other as we learn to tolerate our discomfort and feel feelings we don't want to feel in order to serve the greater good and to sort of diminish some of this trauma. So it takes a real commitment by a group of people.
And with the people you've been working with, can you tell me about some of the issues that you have talked about and, you know, how talking about those things has changed things for the people involved?
Yeah, so I'm part of a group now. There's 8 of us, part of a group working with white supremacy and racism. And we're trying to understand how it shows up in our body, how we turn away, how we contribute to it. And we meet every 2 weeks for 2 hours on Zoom. And we read a book, we'll read articles, we'll watch videos, and then we won't talk about it from our head, from the top down, but we'll talk about it from our body up. And just an issue like racism, what comes up in our body is some people, an issue will come up that really scares them. There's a lot of grief, a lot of feeling overwhelmed, a lot of defensive rage. And so to be in a group like this and that there's no typical response to anything because everybody's got their own history, everybody's got their own level of consciousness. And so just this last week, we talked about it and a couple people were able to, especially this one woman was able to, in a meeting she was in where this one woman, white woman, was complaining about all the focus on the disadvantaged people and all the victims in the world, and she was just really upset. This one white woman was really able to say from a very compassionate way, boy, I know it's really hard to take it in, isn't it? Because it leaves us so uncomfortable. And she brought it in a way, in a compassionate way, but also about the necessity of doing it, that it changed the whole meeting she was in. It helped this one woman sort of quiet down and not feel so ashamed about her defensiveness, but really understand it. And so she was able to do that, which was really beautiful. And in the same meeting, 2 of our participants talked about that they just feel like, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough, and I feel bad about it. And so we helped them go in their bodies and to look at how numbness is so prevalent in white people around this issue, but underneath the whiteness was just this grief they have about living privileged lives and about having it cost so many, especially black people, the price it's cost them. But they were able to feel their grief and a commitment to say that I'm going to do more. I'm not going to stay numb. And so this is this little group I'm part of, and we've been doing it for about 6 months now. And just watching how it changes, how it affects people's lives is just so beautiful.
I'm wondering, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of, well, different small groups forming in different places. Do you see this growing into something bigger? Because I just feel at the moment like there's so much trauma in the world, so much denial and anger and defensiveness. How do we even start to work on that?
Yeah, so I've got some articles and videos on my website, which is movingthroughit.org, moving through it. And it is, Gwyneth, it really does. We really have to do this in small and large groups. And there's enough raw trauma in the world, and there's enough people that are trying to stay out of the polarizing discussions about it, that more and more people are beginning to come together. And the more people do it, the more a group of five people come together in Minneapolis, the more it's happening in Milan, the more it's happening every place. And so we have a long way to go, but we know how to do it. And we know how to come together in these groups and to really literally and figuratively hold each other's hands while we talk about this stuff to help us bear it. Because every time you have more capacity to bear the discomfort, the further into the discussion and the deeper into the healing issue you go. So it's a long, sober road ahead of us, but it's a road that we're finally finding and we're understanding, oh, the more momentum we get going on this road, the faster it's going to change.
And maybe people who don't know how to organize a group, I imagine that even a couple could do a micro healing, right? Like a man and a woman trying to heal these issues that have gone on for so long that you talked about.
Yes. So one of the articles I have on my website, it was a blog for therapists about building a lifeboat to deal with these issues. And that protocol I use could be used by anybody. And it just sort of helps people understand you don't want to go into the deep, deep depths of this trauma. That doesn't heal anything. But you want to just open the door to the discomfort of the grief or the trauma or the overwhelming atrocities and then connect with each other and just to not swim around in the deep ocean of the trauma, but to be in the boat with each other and to say, yeah, let's heal the trauma that just happened in our community where somebody was shot and somebody got away with it. And so how do we, maybe with five people in our neighborhood, just come and talk about it and have some very simple guidelines about how to keep a container so it doesn't get into opinions or it doesn't get overwhelming into feelings. And just, it's the willingness to deal with a little discomfort and to have some very simple guidelines of how to do that. And then it can be done by anybody, just like you were suggesting.
I just wanted to ask, what about, let's say, people who are fresh in the throes of trauma, who might not be able to think so clearly because they're still in that fight or flight mode?
Yes, the word that I use that seems to have the most resonance across groups that seem most people can sort of grab onto is I always talk about when a group comes together, there's a shared intention to talk about whatever the issue is and to feel into the collective goodness of the group, that everybody's here with some goodness in their heart that wants to do something around this collective issue. And so that allows you to be humble. It allows you to be non-judgmental. It gets out of the ego. And it's just like, oh, we are here as people with a shared intention, with a shared goodness, and wanting to deal with the reality of this messy life. And that seems to set the stage for a much more honest and vulnerable and human discussion.
Am I right to say it sounds as if a lot of this conversation has to happen, going into the discomfort and this honesty about, oh, we turned away because we wanted to be comfortable. It sounds as if it involves a lot of stepping outside the ego, right? And in a sort of, whether you call it a Buddhist way or mindfulness or anything like that. So now, if anybody's listening to us now on this podcast and they're starting to think, I feel that I need to process some trauma, or maybe I feel that we as, a society need to talk about this, where can they start?
Well, again, they can go to my website, and if they're working with a collective group, they can feel free to, go to my website and contact me, and to see what ideas I have. And I know some people around the world. But it really, most of us that are involved in this level of social consciousness know others who are. And so it's really finding like-minded people, and it's taking risks. I mean, part of the process of forming a group is uncomfortable. But it's being really clear about the intention about, we've got some old war trauma here. We've got trauma of genocide or the Holocaust or whatever it is. And I would like to start a little group in the community and to be really clear about what the group is about. It's not a discussion group. It's a healing group. It's a vulnerable group. And yeah, so to be really, really clear about the intention and to really reach out to like-minded people.
Are there any other resources that you would recommend? Any, I don't know, books or talks, for example?
You know, I do not. They can go to the pocketproject.org, which is the organization I'm part of. And there's some videos there, there's articles. And what I do every couple months is I go on to Google. I just Google healing collective trauma. And some of the top sites that come up have articles and books. There's one called healingtrauma.com that's got some really good stuff on it. So it's so fresh, it's so new. There's not a lot that I know of yet that I'm recommending.
I'll ask you finally, what are your feelings about the future? Do you feel optimistic that we're going to be able to heal as a collective? Or do you feel like people are going to, I don't know, retreat into their comfort a little bit more?
So I think what my personal thought on that, Gwyneth, is that we are going to be forced into it. And it's not going to be because we want to, because whatever road we go down, there's going to be uncomfortable feelings and some people are going to lose something. And you don't want to do that. White people don't want to lose their privilege, because even though I'm all for it, I know it's going to cost me something. But I think the world is in such a violent and chaotic place. There's so much ripping apart the social fabric of life. I think there's going to be enough people in the middle who don't want to get caught in the polarizing fights. And I think those of us in the middle are going to come together and say, okay, how can we do this differently? So I think it's going to be a worse pain is going to force us to face this pain.
I have the same feeling. So, and we've got, well, we've obviously got the big one that we don't like to talk about, which is the environmental issues, climate change, right? We're destroying our home and we would prefer to have comfort and luxury. So
it is, because it's going to, those of us who can hide from it as best we can are going to be forced into it. It's going to affect our lives directly pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. That's going to be a forced one in the end. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Like anything important?
I've said plenty here. So.
Oh, thank you so much then for talking to me today.
There's a lot to think about here, and I'm not going to start jumping into making any wild assumptions or pretending that I'm an expert in this field. But one thing I have been reading a lot about recently is trauma. And I would recommend on top of this the book The Body Keeps the Score, which is a look at the different ways in which trauma is often stored in our body rather than in our memories. A lot of people don't really have clear memories of traumatic things that have happened to them, and instead it might be that the trauma is stored in their body in the form of random unexplained pain or stiffness, or in anxiety and stress that they don't really understand. So it looks at a lot of different methods of therapy and ways that have helped different people to recover from trauma. In the link connected to the blog, there's also links to Patrick's work. His website, movingthroughit.org, and thepocketproject.org, show you a lot of examples of his work and articles. I've also linked to a few other articles and interviews with him if you're interested in hearing more from Patrick. So just because trauma is not necessarily something that's happened to us individually, as you've heard, doesn't mean that we're not living with some sort of intergenerational collective trauma inside us. This could be the reason for so many things that we do. So let's explore this idea more in future episodes. But for now, go and have a look at the different links I've posted and think about how can we heal these massive societal problems unless we're willing to come together and talk and to be really raw and vulnerable and honest like the people in his stories have been. Next time, we're going to look at what exactly it means to feel safe and to feel trust, whether that's within a relationship or in society, in a group of people. So join me next time on The Way We Connect. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, all under The Way We Connect, or go to thewayweconnect.org to follow the blog, where you'll find extra resources and links for every episode.